Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Katie Anderson. On Tuesday, October 21st, PBS 39 hosted the three candidates running for the 3rd District congressional seat here in Northeast Indiana for a debate. The event was sponsored by IPFW and the Mike Down Center for Indiana Politics. This was the only debate in which the candidates will participate during the 2014 election cycle. On stage for the event was incumbent Republican Marlon Stutzman, Democratic challenger Justin Coonley, and Libertarian challenger Scott Wise. As a service to the community, PBS 39 and the Down Center are allowing us to rebroadcast the event. So today, WBOI presents Indiana's 3rd District Congressional Debate as it originally aired on Tuesday.
Live from the PBS 39 studios in Fort Wayne, Indiana's 3rd District Congressional Debate. Sponsored by the Mike Down Center for Indiana Politics, IPFW, and PBS 39.
Hello, and thanks so much for joining us this evening. This, by the way, is the only debate that you will see amongst the three candidates running for the 3rd District Congressional race here in Northeast Indiana. I'm Jennifer Blomquist, and I will be your moderator for this debate tonight. So again, we appreciate you tuning in to learn more about each of the three candidates running for the race. And I want to remind everybody that we have put a lot of thought into the format of this show and trying to keep it as fair as possible for all three candidates. So let me explain to you the basic guidelines, just so you know that we have fairness at the top of our agenda. Here's the format for the debate. We'll begin with each candidate having 1 minute to give an opening statement. Then we move on to the question portion of the debate, and I will ask the first candidate a question. They will have a minute and a half to answer that question, and then after his response, I'll ask a follow-up question, which the candidate would have 30 seconds to answer if time allows. Then I will ask the same question to the second candidate. He too will have 90 seconds to answer, followed by a 30-second response to a follow-up question. And the same goes on for the third candidate. Now, this pattern of questions and responses will continue for 4 questions, rotating who answers first each time. Now, after the 4th question, each candidate will be given 30 seconds to clarify, correct, or elaborate on previously made points, kind of a rebuttal type of situation. And I'll move on then to more questions, 2 more, that will follow the same pattern we just described. Once the question portion of the debate is complete, we'll wrap things up with each candidate providing a closing statement. So time is of the essence. Without further ado, let's go ahead and get started with our debate tonight. And I'll introduce you, of course, to the three people who are involved in this. Next to me, this is who we're going to begin answering the first question tonight, Scott Wise, the Libertarian candidate. And next to him is the incumbent Republican candidate, Marlon Stutzman. And next to Marlon is Justin Coonley, who is the Democratic candidate for 3rd District Congressional race. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much again for all of you agreeing to participate tonight. And as I said earlier, we're going to begin with our statement, opening statements. We did coin tosses for all of these to keep it as fair as possible. And Justin has agreed to be the first candidate to speak. Go ahead.
I want to thank PBS and Down Center for allowing us the opportunity to come before. Let the people hear the voices of those that are running to represent 3rd District. In the past, I've run really never as a candidate. I've been focused on my social work background as with a degree through business in Purdue. I live in Kendallville with my wife, Beth, and our new infant son, Lincoln. I've also worked in the schools, and what I've seen is the need that a person of the people come up and try and fix the problems that are faced. And that's why I kind of presented myself, that my grandfather gave me a background that if you see a problem and you don't do anything about it, you're just as responsible for not standing up. And I take that to heart. And that's what I'm bringing forth is the family-centered. How do we promote the family?
All right, thank you very much, Justin. And Congressman Marlon Stutzman will be the second one for an opening statement. Go ahead.
All right, thank you. It's great to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to join both Justin and Scott at this evening's debate. Of course, I want to thank WFWA for hosting it, and also the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, and appreciate all the work that Andy Downs does over at IPFW. Of course, we know that we face a lot of challenges in our country today. I, of course, always want to keep my family in mind. My wife, Christy, and I have two sons, Peyton and Preston. We reside in Howe. I come from a family farm and also a small business background. And I've taken those experiences with me to Washington. It's been a real privilege and a real honor to be able to serve the folks from the 3rd Congressional District in Washington, D.C. As I said, you know, we have a lot of challenges today that we face, but I believe more than anything that we have to find ways to meet those challenges and give optimism and hope to future generations, because at the end of the day, we're all Americans and working for the same goal.
All right. Thank you, Marlon. And third for opening statements is Scott Wise, a Libertarian candidate. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you, Jennifer. I want to thank everybody watching on Channel 39, 39 itself, IPFW, Mike Down Center, and thanks to Andy, too. My name is Scott Wise, and I'm running for the 3rd District House seat as a Libertarian. I was born in Columbia City, where I live with my wife and kids. I work in Columbia City at Warner Electric as a continuous improvement manager. I've studied and watched politics and international affairs my entire life. Have a degree from IU in South Bend, and I want to be your congressman.
All right. Thanks to all the candidates for the opening statements. And as we said earlier, we're going to be on a rotating system here for the questions. And we'll begin with four before you have your chances for rebuttal. So let me begin with the first question, and it's about foreign policy and definitely something we hear about on the news every day. Do you support the United States' current policy of conducting aerial strikes against ISIS forces in both Iraq and Syria? Now, if not, would you support an alternative plan, such as arming anti-ISIS groups, working with the Syrian government, conducting ground force operations, or perhaps a policy of complete non-intervention? And Scott, you will be the first candidate to answer this.
Yeah, thank you. That's probably one of the most difficult foreign policy issues we've had in a long time. When we left Iraq, we left a vacuum there, and then we had this Arab Spring that sprung up, and Syria started a civil war there. It was natural for the fighters in Syria to move into to Iraq, where there was no power to oppose them, and they took big swaths of territory. I do support airstrikes at this point. I'm a little worried about it. You know, I studied politics. I studied the Middle East, and I know how interested they are in reestablishing a caliphate. I'm disturbed by the trend. I think that we have to work with forces in the area to help us fight back against the ISIS people. I don't really want to put a bunch of arms in there. We can see the results of that right now. I mean, the ISIS the ISIS units we see have U.S. arms in hand. U.S. tents, U.S. supplies, U.S. Vehicles. So I'm not in favor of putting weapons in their hand, but I am in favor of doing what we can to weaken them and to support the people who oppose them in those areas.
All right, and now we'll go on to, let's see, our second candidate will be Marlon, will be the one to answer this one. Go ahead, Marlon.
Sure. I do support the airstrikes, and of course want to keep all of our men and women who are fighting in the Middle East, keep them in our thoughts and prayers. This is a situation that none of us wanted, none of us felt is necessary. Unfortunately, you know, as Scott mentioned, the president felt that it was necessary to pull all of the troops out of Iraq. He, against the advice of former Secretaries of State, Leon Panetta, and also Secretary Gates. And so, you know, we can look back and we can be critical of the president's decision, which I think we should do, but at the same time, looking forward, we have to realize that if we don't deal with this problem now, that it'll only grow greater, and I believe it will be more of a threat to the United States. ISIS is relentless. They are brutal. They are willing to destroy and kill anyone in their way, whether it be Muslims, Christians, anyone that disagrees with them. They are willing to eliminate them. And I think that it would be a mistake to arm Syrian rebels or any rebels, for that matter, in the Middle East right now, because we don't know who are our friends. And the last thing we want is for those weapons to be pointed back at our own military. And so I do believe that we are eventually going to have troops on the ground to some extent, unless the airstrikes prove to be more successful.
All right, thank you, Marlon. And Justin, your final thoughts here.
I approve of the airstrikes going on right now. One of the most essential things is to understand that it was a combination of us pulling their troops out, but also us having al-Maliki's corrupt government in place. When you don't include, when the tribes of Iraq were never included, you left a vacuum for the tribes to feel unappreciated and not a part of the system. And you saw how that happened when ISIS was taking over northern Iraq. The Iraqi army was laying down their arms or turning their backs and joining ISIS. It's going to be a continuing problem unless it's a regional approach to it. When I watch reports of Kobani that's about ready to fall, but watch Turkish battalions sit across the border and just watch the airstrikes happening and not being a part of it, my fear is that it's just going to be coming another United States war unless we get regional partnerships to actually take part and do something about the ISIS threat. For us to put our troops on the ground just puts it as an American war. And with a war-weary nation the way we are, it's going to continue to be a problem that's just going to be hassled. We have to have an exit strategy, and right now that does not appear to be.
All right. Thank you, Justin. And we do have follow-up questions for this. Scott, I'm going to give you this one based on some of the comments you made earlier. It has been said that politics makes strange bedfellows. So how closely, with that in mind, should the United States work with Iran to address the issue of ISIS?
I don't think we can trust Iran. And this is a spooky area. I mean, this is a biblical turf. I worry about it, and I'm not certain what to do about it. But I don't think Iran is going to be helping us any. I'm about out of time, but the Turks make it complicated. It was mentioned, and the Kurds, and it's a mess over there, and there isn't any good answer. But we need to take care of Americans first and foremost.
All right, thank you. Marlon, your follow-up question is, there are some who believe that the United States should seek out more partners to help address ISIS. Turkey, of course, is a major power in that region. So what are your thoughts about the United States putting pressure on Turkey? If not, why not? But if you think they should, why should it be pressuring, or what should we be pressuring Turkey to do? Or example, should we be arming the Kurds or putting their own troops on the ground?
The Kurds are probably our best allies in the region. I do think that this is a moment for the president and for us as a country to put pressure on those countries who say they're against terror, but have not acted in that manner all the time. This is an opportunity for us to flesh them out and say, listen, if you are with us on the fight against terror, we need you to step up to the table and to fight as well. The president needs to stop announcing to our enemies what we will not do. And so I believe all options should be on the table.
All right, thank you. Justin, given Northeast Indiana's history of welcoming refugees from various war-torn countries over the past two decades, what do you think? Should we volunteer to resettle refugees from the Syrian crisis here as well?
I'd be hard-pressed to accept that. We've been very welcoming as far as with the Burmese population and have seen us open up our doors and welcome mats for other nations. However, when we look at the needs of as far as what Northeast Indiana has, we can't continue to be that open door policy. We have to have a needs of our citizens come first. We can be opening, we can work with the governments over there, but we can't become the babysitter that they need. They need help, and that's what we need to do, is provide the help.
All right. Thank you to all the candidates for that, all your answers to question number one. We'll move on to question number two now, which is more of a national issue. We've seen a lot of commercials, I'm sure you've seen them as well, on television lately, asking for donations for charities to help wounded veterans. And I have to say, some of them really pull at your heartstrings, very emotional, and they involve the whole family and the veterans' children as well. In light of that, why is there even a need for the private sector to help pay for disabled veterans? Isn't that supposed to be the job of the Veterans Administration? So what would you do to rectify that situation and provide necessary support for our veterans? And Marlon, you're the first one to answer here.
Well, I would never want to discourage private citizens, charitable organizations, folks who are willing to contribute, supporting our veterans. That's one of the greatest things that we as a nation feel very strongly about, that we do need to make sure that our veterans receive a warm welcome when they come home, and also have the best tools they can, that we can provide, and help them transition back into civil society if they choose to leave the military. When it comes to the VA, we have a real problem here. This has been another administration that has failed, and I see a lot of the work done at the local level, like right here at the Fort Wayne VA, and how hard local administration works to help our VA, our veterans. But then there's this a lot of miscommunication between the local level and the national level and local offices. So I would say that we in Congress have a responsibility to fix those problems. The administration has a responsibility to fix those problems within the VA. But I think as we work together as citizens of a great country, because of men and women who are willing to put their lives on the line and help them not only re-enter back into society, but contribute, I think that's that generosity is always should always be welcomed.
All right. Thank you, Marlon. Justin, you are second to reply.
I would agree with Marlon Stutzman that the veterans are essentially who we need to care for. However, what I've also seen is Congress be so willing to leave D.C., come back to their districts, and not address the problems that are in the VA. A lot of what we've seen with the VA as far as approach has been knee-jerk reactions, short-term fixes, if you even want to call it that. The effort has not been put forth to actually help our veterans out in what they need. Traveling across Northeast Indiana, you see countless homeless veterans that are out there. But to go back to the question as far as the charities go, a lot of times what we watch is that the veterans charities that are out there, most of the costs that people donate to go to administration costs. It doesn't go to helping either find locations for the homeless to come back out or to get the care that they need. And that's where the drive should be, is, as the country, we need to come forth and provide for our veterans. They put their lives on the line to serve our nation. We deserve to show that same respect when they come back and to continue to give back to the veterans, because they are essentially our heart and soul.
All right. Thank you, Justin and Scott. Your third reply.
Yeah. When our veterans sign up to serve, we make a promise to them. We tell them we're going to take care of them. And time and time and time again, we find that we're not taking care of them. I think it's one of the primary responsibilities of government to live up to its promises. A promise made should be a promise kept. Unfortunately, the veterans are one of the first groups of people in the federal government to feel budget cuts. And in my opinion, we tell them we're going to take care of their health care needs, and we should take care of their health care needs. Regardless of how we do that, if we find that it's too expensive to keep a specific place for them, or if they can't get that kind of treatment at that particular VA hospital, our veterans should be able to go wherever they can get that treatment, and we should pick up the tab. In terms of charities and these people who want to support the veterans coming home and their families, I'm all for that, but I think that we should help make them comfortable in that regard and not have to provide for their health care or their wheelchairs or their access to their homes. These people fought, they bled for us, and we should take care of them. And the donations to charity should go to help take care of their children and educate their children, things that they may not be able to do since they're wounded and may not be able to work quite as well as they used to. So I think charity should go towards that thing, and I think our government should take care of the veterans when they come home in their medical care.
All right, thank you. And now the follow-up questions for this, and Marlon, we'll begin with you again. Would you support providing additional funds for the care of veterans without requiring any reduction of funds elsewhere in the system and independent of other issues? Should it be a standalone piece of legislation?
No, I don't think it should. We just passed a bill at the end of August with dealing, once we discovered and learned about the problems within the VA administration, I've met Secretary Eric Shinseki several times and never suspected that we would see the problems that we did. I believe that we need accountability, we need responsibility there, And before we just throw more money at a problem, we need to find the systematic problems that are within the VA and expect answers and expect results and expect changes to serve our veterans.
All right, thank you. Justin, your question for follow-up here is, unfortunately, as we all know, we live in a world of limited resources. I wish it was unlimited. If we focus on the services you think are most important, what will the trade-offs be? So in other words, what would we not be able to provide if we turn our resources in that direction?
With VA, I think there's essentially a balance that we can have, and that's a partnerships with our local healthcare systems, such as Parkview's, Lutheran's. With those groups and working in tandem with the VAs, you can actually develop a streamlined continuity of care where a vet that doesn't have access to a specialist at the VA can have the charts follow them to the local hospitals through the ERs, but then have the VA pick up the tab of that, because that's really what's afforded. It's not reassessing our values or money, but it's letting the vet actually choose where they're going.
All right, thank you. And Scott, your final follow-up question here is, if the private sector is going to provide services for disabled veterans, what should those be, and why shouldn't the government provide them?
Those services should be whatever it is that the veteran needs that they can't get through the VA or through the government. I don't know that it matters to me very much if the government physically provides it or if they contract someone to provide it. The fact of the matter is that sometimes it may be less expensive for us to have a local caregiver take care of that service. And I think that we should explore those opportunities and take advantage of them. But we should find ways to do more with less.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for all of your responses. And we'll move on to our third question. It's about student debt, which sadly is estimated to be at $1 trillion right now. And there are fears that this debt could be the next big, significant financial crisis in our country. At the same time, of course, we all know that a post-high school degree or certificate is the key to people earning higher incomes in our nation. So how should the federal government balance averting a financial crisis caused by student debt while at the same time encouraging post-high school education? And Justin, you're the first one to respond.
I think having high schools provide for training classes going into college is essential. I think in September of 2013, it actually topped the $1 trillion mark. That was in September of 2012. I believe the latest estimate shows it at $1.3 trillion. And that's just the federal subsidized. That's not including private student loans, which unfortunately doesn't have an actual number amount to it, but is estimated to be three times that amount. One thing that hurts people is they don't have the job readiness skills to go into it. A lot of kids that go into college don't have an idea as far as what grades or what kind of classes they want to take, what kind of degree, career they want. So a lot of times they bounce between careers. And I personally was responsible for that. I was the same way, going in thinking I wanted to be in computer networking and end up in organizational leadership. You know, it's a trade-off, but you learn about yourself in the process of that. And I think essentially it can be partnered back with your local community colleges, such as your Ivy Techs, but give them internships, give them abilities to kind of get a feel for what types of careers are out there to get a good fit for what you are most trained for and what your benefit would be. I think as far as what we could do for the student loan debt is cap the interest rates. You know, right now the variable rate is over 6%. You know, cap it at, say, arbitrarily 2.5%. Give a starting point so that students can actually survive and not be drowning in debt for the rest of their lives.
All right, thank you. And now we'll turn it to Scott for his response.
Yeah, I think education is very important, but I think it's a fallacy to think that more money buys you more education. I think we should work to encourage colleges and universities to hold the line on their fees and tuitions. I cannot believe how much fees and tuitions have gone up since I was in college. I know wages haven't gone up that much. And you look around and, you know, along with hospitals, some of these colleges are the nicest palaces you see from one city to the next. They have endowments that are filled with millions and millions of dollars of money. I'm all for giving assistance to people who have need. People who prove that they're ready to learn and want to learn and go get a career and can't fund it themselves. I'm all for providing loans for students who aren't in that situation, who want to learn but don't have the money, don't necessarily have the need like some other people do. But I think those loans should be more market-based. If the market has a low interest rate, then so be it. If the market has a high interest rate, then you have to make decisions, just like you do as a consumer in real life. There's lots of education out there that's not at college. The School of Hard Knocks is free. There are internships. There are apprenticeships. There's no guarantees in this world. You have to go out there and you have to make your way.
All right. Thank you, Scott. And Marlon, you're the last one to respond to this one.
Well, you know, first of all, the first step in the long walk towards the American dream is a good education. And as we see, this is becoming a much greater problem for young people and students. I was actually just visiting the IPFW campus today and got to hear some of the thoughts from students there about the challenges that they face. And, you know, one of the things that I believe we should be doing for young people is focusing again on the cost of education. This is what happened in the debate over healthcare. We talked about how are we going to cover the cost of healthcare rather than focusing on what the cost of healthcare was. I think we should focus on the cost of education. Higher education has grown faster than the cost of healthcare, as Scott alluded to. And one of the things that we need from our state legislatures, from our school, or from our boards, from our presidents, is for them to hold the line on the cost of education. I think that it's critical that we have schools like Ivy Tech and other schools that are providing an education that is costing less to the student, so we're creating competition in the marketplace. Mitch Daniels has been very creative at Purdue University, where he has actually frozen tuition rates for 3 years. That gives stability to families and young people who are wanting to get that education so they can accomplish their dream. Government, unfortunately, manipulates the markets too much, and I think that government has to withdraw and let the real market handle the interest rates.
Okay, thank you. And now we'll go on to the follow-up question, and again, we'll go back to you, Justin. You somewhat touched on this a little bit before when you were talking about things maybe we could do in high school before these students are of college age. But what else do you think the federal government can do to help students avoid incurring debt even before it falls into place?
I think one of the things you can do in high school is what we did was aptitude test. Get a feel for what a person can do. Those are free tests. Those are really found online. And it gives a kid an incentive to kind of get a feel for who they are as a person. And I think that's the part where we need to start affording those opportunities to develop. We can't teach just to a textbook. We have to give the real life experiences. And a lot of those times you can even get them to a college, let them tour a class that's going on to get a feel for what class is like.
All right. Thank you, Justin. And Scott, your question. There's a great deal of focus on people earning degrees, so-called STEM, the acronym STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math degrees. Is this where education should be focusing its attention? Or what do you think about disciplines that promote things like creativity or just the traditional liberal arts degrees?
I like the liberal arts degrees. I think it makes students think. And of course, you mentioned science, technology, engineering. That's also something that's going to make people think. So I'm not opposed to liberal arts, but I think that if we're going to encourage students to have higher education, then we should be strategic about that. And we have great need for scientists, for engineers. So if we're going to facilitate any assistance to education, we should focus it in that way.
All right. Thank you. And Marlon, your question is, two common suggestions for this problem are to decrease the interest rates on student loans or forgive a student loan if that student agrees to engage in service to our community. So do you think these options make sense?
I think that they could. I think that, you know, again, we focus on the cost of education to keep that low. But for a lot of the students today who have a tremendous amount of debt, letting the market dictate what the interest rates are. If you look at what interest rates are today, they're lower than they've been in a long, long time. Why those loans don't reflect similar interest rates, I think is unfair to these students, and that if we let the market help them find a place for those loans to be repaid is something that would be helpful to them in the long run. And then they need a good job once they come out of school.
All right. Thank you again to all of you for answering our third question. We'll move on to the fourth question. Of course, after this, you have your chance for rebuttals. And Scott, you'll be the first one to answer. People have said that Congress is broken, and they will cite congressional approval ratings that are hovering right now around the 13% mark, and the fact that legislators are introducing fewer bills, and fewer bills are getting passed. So my question to all of you is Congress broken?
Of course it is. Yeah, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody that says it's not. And sometimes I think that the lack of legislation, the lack of new laws is a good thing. I very much believe that Congress should be engaged in activity that reduces the size of government, that works them out of a job, so to speak. It's not the 1700s, so we probably need a little bit more government than maybe what we thought of initially. However, we should stick to the guideline that federal government is limited, and we should stick to the roles that we plan for the federal government to take on, and let the states and local governments take care of a lot of domestic issues that the federal government has taken upon itself to try to solve. As I look around from one program to another, I have a difficult time finding something that the government does well. One could say the U.S. military, and I'm all for the U.S. military, and they do a great job, but you let the politicians get involved in that, and we've got a mess on our hands. So when they run wild in Washington, when they play the political games, when they keep bills from coming to the floor because it's not their particular party, I think that's wrong, and I think it's wrong-minded of our government to continue to allow that to happen.
All right. Thank you very much. And Marlon, you're the next to respond.
Yes, I would say Washington, Congress is broken right now. It is not working the way that it was designed to work. It is designed to work to allow people to bring ideas to the floors for debate and for discussion. If you you look at what has happened between the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, you have two very different pictures. In the House of Representatives, where Republican leadership has allowed Democrats to bring amendments to the floor, we have passed over 350 bills that are sitting over in the Senate that are waiting for discussion and for debate. In the Senate, bills are not passing. Bills are not being discussed and debated. Harry Reid has locked down the Senate. And because of the rules in the Senate, it is holding a lot of bills from being heard actually moving forward. I think that there's two problems. One, the regular order. We need the regular process of how bills come through committee. They go to the floor. Amendments can be offered by either party. And let us vote on tough issues, because that's what we're there for. We're there to fix problems. And then also the scoring that is done by the Congressional Budget Office. Oftentimes those numbers come back and they'll tell Congress that it'll either reduce the deficit or it'll increase the deficit. And we've seen some really, the scores that have come back from CBO have been wrong. One in particular was on Obamacare. That was much more costly to the American taxpayer than what was told to Congress at the time. I think that should be something that should be fixed as well.
All right, thank you. And Justin, you're the final one to respond here.
In a word, yes, Congress is broken. And it's broken because with 13%, 90% of them are going to return to office. You know, as I've been terming it, that's the status quo that's got to go, because if we continue to believe that we keep sending the same representatives back to Congress and we expect them to change their ways, we're fooling ourselves as citizens. We have to understand that, you know, when you're talking about sending bills to either side, what the full story is, yeah, 300 bills have gone that are jobs bills, but it's not just sitting on a desk. It's sitting in committees. It's sitting in the compromise committees. It's being discussed, and there is a small fraction that still sits on the desk, but in the true sense of it, you have to work with each other. You have to bring your ideas and sit at a table and discuss what the problems are. A lot of times what we do is we focus only on what our differences is and not what we hold together. If you came through with the problem and you sat down, you could say, what do we agree with? And that's a better starting point than says, what do we disagree with? But too often Congress is so quick to say, I don't agree with that, and I'm going to stand my ground and say no. And it's time that we have to stop saying no to every little thing and start saying, what can we do together? What can we do to make our country and our future brighter?
All right, thank you. And now time for our follow-up question for this. And Scott, your question, it's quite likely that if you're elected, you would be the only libertarian in Congress. So what can you as one person do to rectify this situation?
Well, I've been thinking about this for a long time. I want to change the world. And were I elected to Congress, it would change the world, in Washington at least. I would be the outsider. I believe in the Constitution. I think that the liberty that it gives us is really important. And I would find people in Congress who think the same way, and I would form a coalition that was vocal about these issues. And hopefully that you could build a coalition that could become a majority despite the parties.
All right, thank you. And Marlon, your question is, if Republicans do end up taking control of Congress in both the House and the Senate, would things change? Do you think the federal government would be able to get more done if the Republicans were at the advantage?
I do. And I would just say this, you know, in spite of the situation right now in Washington, the Journal-Gazette actually just reported this last Sunday about a legislative effective study that was done by the University of Virginia and Vanderbilt. And I was the highest rated member from Indiana in legislative effectiveness. And you know, that is a thing. We have to find ways to get things done. People are expecting Congress to address the problems that we deal with today. And in spite of the problems that we have there, I've still worked very hard to be able to still get policy passed. And so I just think that, yes, we will get more done because you're going to have Republicans in the Senate actually debating bills.
All right. Thank you, Marlon. And now it's time for our comment period, or if you want to call it a rebuttal section. And we're going to do a little different format here. This is based on a coin toss, so we'll do away with the order that we've been using for the questions. And Scott, you were the one who were going to comment first. So you have 30. Each of you has 30 seconds.
Okay. I'd like to go back to foreign policy a little bit. And we talked about ISIS, and I think that it's a topic that's on everyone's minds right now. But I'd like to remind everyone that since the fall of the Soviet Union, we believed that it was a safe world out there, one where we didn't need a strong America. You have China probing the Pacific Ocean. You have the Russians probing the Arctic Circle. And I think it's very important that we have a strong United States government in foreign affairs, and that we implement our goals throughout the world.
All right, thank you, Scott. And Justin, you've been very polite for waiting. I apologize, but I forgot to give you a chance to do a follow-up question based on the question about Congress being broken. So my question to you, and again, this is a 30-second question, we'll return then to the comments. If a lot of Hoosiers do support limited involvement of the government in their lives, so is it necessarily a bad thing in Hoosier eyes if Congress is not getting a lot done?
Limited involvement in Congress is essential. I mean, the federal government has been far-reaching in a lot of affairs that really they shouldn't touch on. However, Congress needs to understand that they do have a role, and their role is to function as the people's house. Their role is to provide for a budget. Their role is to provide for funding for certain programs and for our military. But what we keep seeing is time and time again, they get the opportunities to do it, and they kick the can short term down the road.
All right. My many deepest apologies to you. I apologize for that. Let's return now to the comment portion of our program. Of course, Scott just gave it. You don't get to go again, Scott, but thank you. I want to remind everybody that he has delivered his address there, and now it's Marlon's turn.
Well, I'd like to follow up a little bit on the foreign matters that we're dealing with as well. We need a strong leader addressing the situation in the Middle East. Of course, you look at what's going on with the Ukraine and Russia, and people around the world look at the United States and watch, what are we going to do? How are we going to handle a problem? And we have to lead with determination, we have to lead with clarity, and we have to let people know that if you are going to hurt those who are vulnerable, hurt those in your own country, that if it goes on and there's not a coalition built around it, that we're going to lead the way, and we need a strong president that'll do that.
All right, thank you, Marlon. And Justin, your chance now for some comments.
One of the things about student loan debt that really was never really addressed is one aspect of increasing Pell Grants. That's been a common core piece that has bipartisan support in getting additional equipment into the schools. However, also when you look at schools, I mean, I look at Purdue, and they have frozen the rates, but I'm still watching how more and more of the high-tech buildings are being constructed, and I wonder, where's the focus on the kid? Where's the focus on the student that's attending?
All right. Thank you to all three of you for your comments. And we do have two more questions as part of the debate. And again, we'll go back to the same rotating system that we had when we did the first four questions. And we begin now with Marlon. You're the first one to respond to this. There are rumors that Saudi Arabia will allow oil prices to drop to $80 a barrel. Today, the closing price was a little over $82. Allowing it to drop to $80 a barrel could have domestic and international consequences. So what do you see as the most important consequences should this happen?
Well, you know, I think that we need to control our own energy resources, and that's one of the things that I believe is happening right now. As we watch the situation in the Middle East with ISIS situation and with the turmoil there, that generally we would see higher prices at the pump. Today we're actually seeing prices here in the northeastern part of the state below $3 in some at some stations. That's because we're the private sector is creating new technology and is whether it's horizontal drilling, they are going to more places and using the old wells that may have not been used before to tap into, and so we're controlling more of our own destiny when it comes to energy. Technology has come a long way in the energy industry, and you know, so if Saudi Arabia chooses to do so, they better be very careful because you know, we don't have to buy more foreign oil. In fact, we're becoming a an exporter in energy, and I think that's what we should continue. Our policy should continue to point businesses and companies towards more exploration, towards more opportunity that's around the country, and giving them the tools that they need to do that. And so when we control our own resources, and we don't have to then depend on other countries who may not like us so much and make things much more difficult on our economy.
All right, thank you. And now, Justin, you'll be the second to reply.
It's discouraging to hear that Saudi Arabia use their oil prices as a way to counterbalance what we're doing as far as our own oil explorations here in the United States. You know, as Congressman Stutzman pointed out, we're on tap to be our own best resource for oil production in 2015. However, I'm a fan of history because my belief is if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. And what we're watching out with the sub-$3 gas is it's an election year. And historically, gas prices come down during an election year. And I've always questioned, why is that? But to go back to the point of Saudi Arabia and oil, conflict usually increases the price. And what we can do is look to Saudi Arabia and say, you know, what's going on with that? It's not a market-based driven system. It is in a word, manipulation in some ways. But what we can do is look to what can we do to have an all-of-the-above approach for us so that we don't have to rely on Saudi Arabia fluctuating their prices just at a whim. What can we do to become more energy independent? But that takes an all-of-the-above approach. That way, so when Saudi Arabia does produce and say, we're going below $80, well, it doesn't really affect us now.
All right. Thank you, Justin. And Scott, your response.
$80 oil is great. Means we all get an extra $20 in our pocket to buy our family's dinner. If you remember right, in 2008, when the economy kind of was ready to go over the cliff, we just hit the $4 a gallon mark. We were approaching that number again, and unfortunately, that kind of thing just sucks the money out of consumers' pockets. The everyday person has a difficult time affording it. The other thing about this is that every dollar that Saudi Arabia gets from oil revenue, there's a good chance some of that's going to end up in the hands of Islamic fundamentalists. That's not a good thing. They're one of the biggest funders of terrorists in the world. We won't face that truth. We ignore that truth. The downside is that it could back Russia into a corner. Russia's teetering as it is. They're reeling from the economic sanctions that have been placed on them. They really need to get out of the Ukraine, but now it's a matter of losing face for them, if nothing else. Low oil prices are going to hurt Russia, and I worry a little bit about what their response will be. You know, they could try to light a fire somewhere else that would send oil prices skyrocketing because there's conflict. So I like cheap oil. My wife likes cheap oil. We can put gas in the car and it doesn't break us. It's good for the U.S. economy, and I say we should keep pumping oil too.
All right, thank you. And now we'll go quickly for our follow-up responses. Again, 30 seconds for each response. I'll start with you, Marlin. Recently, U.S. producers of oil and natural gas passed Saudi Arabia, and the production does not seem to be slowing. So if production is so robust, is it time for the government to redirect support of the petroleum industry, perhaps to other forms of energy?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, when the rules are set, we want to level a playing field as much as possible. And any time that something changes, we shouldn't have the government coming in and changing the rules one way or the other. I do think that we can actually make it much easier, whether it's permits, whether it's for natural gas, whether it is allowing startup companies, those tax credits for small businesses, extend those and keep those available for small businesses to get started, because it's those small businesses in this industry that are really helping us beat Saudi Arabia and other countries as well. And so, you know, when we're taking advantage of our own resources, that's a good thing for the American family.
All right, thank you. Justin, dropping oil prices puts economic pressure on Iran, but also has a negative effect on U.S. producers. So how should the federal government balance out those competing interests?
It's really a balancing act. And as you mentioned, it is a balancing act. But we can't look at, you know, what can we do for oil producers or what can we do to kind of prop it up or to make it fair. Government shouldn't be in the position to dictate that. And when government gives out corporate subsidies, as far as with the oil producers, they're hedging their bets on who's going to be the winner. And what we can do is to say, you know, how does free market work? Can we do a balance that everybody benefits from it?
All right. Thank you, Justin. And Scott, your question is going to be similar to Justin's. You had touched upon the situation with Russia and this issue. So if we put pressure, if our dropping oil prices puts economic pressure on Vladimir Putin and Russia, of course, it also would have a negative effect on U.S. producers. So how should the federal government look at that situation as far as competing interests?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of trust that's been lost there. We went along for a while thinking that Russia was not an adversary. We helped him out in tough financial times. But I think you have to understand that Vladimir Putin is an old school Soviet guy, a KGB guy. He believes in Russia. He wants to restore the glory to Mother Russia. We have to keep that in mind at all times. At the same time, we have to understand the strategic nature of things and guard against him feeling like he's backed into a corner. I think we should be working behind the scenes. It doesn't have to be real public. It doesn't have to be in your face. But we need to be reaching out to Putin and figure out a way through this conflict.
I'm sorry, we'll have to end it at that. The clock was incorrect, so the 30
seconds
is up.
I thought I had all kinds of time.
Yeah, I thought so too. Okay, thank you, gentlemen, for your responses to all those. We have one more question to answer, and I do want to tell you, because time is of the essence, there will not be a follow-up question to our sixth question. So we'll begin with Justin responding first. This question is about infrastructure. So according to the American Society for Civil Engineers 2013 report card for America's infrastructure, our country earned a rating or a grade of D plus, and the report estimated that we would need to invest $3.6 trillion by the year 2020. So how do we get to this point, or how did we get to this point, and then who's responsible for getting us out of this situation? And go ahead, Justin.
Sure, thank you. That's been one of my quintessential pieces that I focus on with it, and I've seen the same scorecard rating, and I've watched how the 13 scores are pretty dismal, and D plus rating, that just screams at me that we have not done enough. And a lot of it has come with government inaction. They haven't worked with the private community. They haven't worked with local and state governments as far as what we can do to balance it. And when we look at it, you know, we're looking at state roads here in Indiana that are being chipped and sealed. We're looking at ongoing construction that is not really benefiting anyone. If anything, it adds to congestion, which increases oil consumption with our gasoline. But we were looking at bridges that are decaying. We're looking at waterways that continue to get polluted or to continue to get degraded. The American Civil Engineer Society gave a map, a guideline, as far as where to address the needs at in the communities. And I've kind of worked with, in my knowledge of that, and developed a plan that actually focuses on all 13 so that we can start producing it. And I think they call for $3.6 trillion over 5 years to 2020, if I believe. But that's where it comes from. These are the people that know the systems. They know where the improvements need to be lying at, and we need to listen to the people that are on the front lines as far as what they're saying our cities and our communities need.
All right. Thank you, Justin. Scott, you're second to respond.
Yeah, I wrote a term paper in 1990, I think, that talked about the fall of the Soviet Union and the fact that China was not a strong adversary yet. And we had a window of time to turn inward and work on our infrastructure. Unfortunately, that was like $14 trillion of debt ago, and we didn't do anything about it. Our infrastructure is a critical factor in this country, and we have to take care of it. It needs to become a higher priority, and it's one of the few things that I think the federal government should involve itself in. I talk a lot about cutting the size of the federal government and sending the money back to the states and local governments. I think that some of it has to go into our federal highway system, some of it has to go into our bridges, but some of it has to go to pay the debt down. So we reduce the size of the government, we take care of the business that we need to take care of, and we turn money back over to states and local governments. That's the plan. I've been hearing about it since 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected, but we haven't seen hide nor hair of it. It disturbs me that this is a very good example of how we've refused to take care of the basic necessities of our country. We talk and we talk and we talk and we make this plan and we make that plan and we create a new program here and we spend billions and billions of dollars and we borrow it, but we won't take care of our own backyard.
All right, thank you, Scott. And Marlon, you have the final word here.
Well, this infrastructure and transportation should be one of the federal government's highest priorities right after our national defense. What we need is roads and bridges to help commerce and a growing economy. And unfortunately, we haven't had the leadership in Washington to deal with this particular issue. I believe that we're too heavily dependent on the gas tax. We have cars that are actually doing better on gas mileage. We are consuming less per mile than what we were 20, 30 years ago. We should reevaluate our priorities. As Scott mentioned, transportation should be one of the top priorities. And in a time when Washington, as we talked about earlier, is not working, we should be working on transportation. Transportation should not be a partisan issue. It should be a bipartisan issue where we can work together with both sides, with both parties, where we all have needs. We have, you know, roads in California need to be fixed, just like roads in Indiana need to be fixed. And so we should be able to have both parties coming together. But we haven't had a president who is willing to come to Congress and say, this is one area where we should all be able to find common ground and fix a problem. I think that tax reform would be a great place to start. I have no problem taking money out of the general fund to pay for roads and infrastructure, because we have become, as I said, too heavily dependent on gas tax. Let's make that a priority and say that we're willing to invest in roads and bridges, in the infrastructure that's going to help a 21st century economy. And I think you'll find a lot of bipartisan support if we have the leadership.
All right. Thank you to everybody for their answering question six. And now we move on to our closing statements. Each of you will have 60 seconds to respond. And again, the order changes a little bit due to a coin toss before the program. So, Justin, you will be the first to give your response. Go ahead.
Throughout this general election, I have been focusing on listening to the stories of the 3rd District. And that has led me to 12 different counties, lots of different communities, and lots of different faces. But quintessentially, what they're asking for is for Congress to work together. You know, Congressman Stutzman talks about wanting to have a bipartisan approach to our infrastructure needs. And then when the time comes for a one-time short-term solution, he votes against it. And that's our highway trust fund. You know, that is essentially what our infrastructure is based on. And we need to put that emphasis on what is important and our military and our infrastructure is desperately important. However, we can't just continue to look at it as far as, you know, we talk a good talk, but when it comes to action, we don't act. So through me, electing me, we're going to get in a fighter. We're going to get somebody that is going to fight for the common good and that one that will balance the budget. So I ask for your vote on November 4th.
All right. Thank you, Justin. And of course, we do want to remind everybody, November 4th, just 2 weeks from today. So our debate is over. I appreciate all three of you participating. And once again, for the audience. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess we're closing the show and we still have closing statements to go to. Marlon, you're the second one to go. And again, 60 seconds.
All right. Well, thank you, first of all, to the Mike Downs Center and, of course, to PBS 39 for hosting the debate tonight, to both Justin and to Scott as well for their participation. You know, I believe that America faces some tremendous problems right now, and we need strong leadership in Washington, D.C. I've been very humbled and honored to serve the 3rd Congressional District in Washington for the past 4 years, and I will continue to fight every day to make sure that America is strong, that our economy is growing, and continue to push back on the regulations that hurt American families on a daily basis. One of the taxes that was in Obamacare was a medical device tax. That is taking millions of dollars out of Northeast Indiana on a monthly basis. We see regulations continue to slow down small businesses. People can't hire the way that they were able to. People are trying to find ways to make ends meet right now, and we need a strong economy where we're seeing wages increase and people have more opportunity. And so I would ask for your vote on November the 4th to be reelected to the United States House of Representatives.
All right. Thank you, Marlon. And again, a minute for you, Scott, for your final comments.
Thank you. Our government is bankrupt, literally and figuratively. We all know it. We let the same people who buried us under this mountain of debt and corruption continue to rule. They rule to sustain their power. They sell ideas to us and our children. The government is the answer. They're afraid people will find their voice and reclaim the republic. So they spy on us, they arm agencies with no police power, and they arm the police like a military. I believe in the Constitution. The liberty and the independence it offers are unique among nations, and the fuel that made America great. I believe others think this way, and I will work to build a vocal coalition that, God willing, will become a majority and put these two corrupt parties on the sidelines. My name is Scott Wise, and I'm asking for your vote for U.S. Congress.
All right, thank you very much, Scott. And again, Scott Wise, Marlon Stutzman, Justin Coonley, thank you so much to all of you. 2 weeks from today is Election Day. I want to remind everybody the polls are open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. in Indiana. Everybody's vote counts, so don't think that you're wasting your time by any means. We hope for a good turnout at the polls. And I want to remind you again that on Election Day, the polls are open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. I think I already told you that. I'm Jennifer Blomquist. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. Take care and have a good evening.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of Indiana's 3rd District Congressional Debate, which originally aired live on Tuesday, October 21st on PBS 39. A big thank you to everyone at PBS 39 and to the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics for planning and airing the debate and for allowing us to rebroadcast it. And thank you to the candidates for coming together for their one and only debate of this election cycle. If you'd like to listen to the debate again, it will be available on our website, WBOI.org. And if you'd like to view a recording of the debate as it originally appeared on television, you can find it at WFWA.org/local shows. That's all the time we have. WBOI Presents is produced by Sean Beter and myself. I'm Katie Anderson. Join us next time for another edition of WBOI Presents.